through the Honorable Karl Popper, how the individual body experience is civilized through the funnel of signs and rationality. Before the start of the Industrial Revolution, von Humboldt wrote, "One-sided rational domination, dryness and sobriety are the unfailing consequences when a language expands and becomes more refined intellectually. It makes no sense crying over spoiled milk, neither does it make sense to lament the loss of the unity of the sensorium within the sciences. In the course of the Industrial Revolution, the early decades of the 20th century, and the reign of modernity, the inner soul, the inner life, too, has been lost in scientific discourse. One does not need to romanticize its existence to evaluate the effects of its disappearance. The disappearance of the unity of the sensorium and its subsequent eradication of the a priori individual body are determined by a scientific method which seeks to exclude the animate drive behind material things. The method originates from the natural sciences. Its language consists of Cartesian abstractions composed through formulas and clear-cut boundaries of premises. Though this is not exactly the language which von Humboldt had in mind when he wrote of rational domination, its consequences are plain. Karl Popper lived from 1902 to 1995. His intellectual work is for a very large part inspired by the working methods from the natural sciences. Popper views his own theory as an objectivist theory. In this sense, he is an absolute rationalist, and his work is fully built on the logic of the external world of phenomena. Popper is famous for his ideas on falsification of the scientific hypothesis by testing, and he himself was convinced he had invented the scientific method of falsification. Irony it is that Charles Darwin introduced the method of falsification 50 years before Popper invented it. In 1871, Darwin wrote in his Presentation of Hypothesis, "False facts are highly injurious to the progress of science, for they often endure long but false views. If supported by some evidence, they do little harm, for everyone takes a salutary pleasure in proving their falseness, and when this is done, one path towards error is closed, and the road to truth is often at the same time opened." Charles Darwin might not have known the consequences of his views, or maybe he did, but the testing of hypotheses as a refutation method in social science since then had a devastating effect on social emancipation. The domination of the external world view immediately connected the testing of hypotheses with the moral order of society. Reality could be changed for moral order of society, and this, combined with the natural history of man, made social science into ruling class gender and race method. In social science, the external world consisted of society, which functioned according to the principle of exception makes the rule, rather than the other way around. The method of refutation, therefore, had a far-reaching effect in the relation between the individual body and society. The individual body itself became the site for refutation, and the result of a continuous refutation accentuated the idea of ambiguity. Gradually, the performative aspects of individual bodies became the center of attention in science, and the concept of consensus itself seemed, in turn, to underlie this idea of ambiguity. This philosophical development occurred simultaneously in objectivist as well as in subjectivist approaches of the body. Though in anthropology, the subjectivist approach seemed more suitable to understand the radical other, it simultaneously the concept of ambiguity resulted in the loss of the radical other as individual.
For instance, in his rationalist approach, Karl Popper seems to be the antagonist of Maurice Merleau-Ponty, who questions both intellectualist and associationist theories of perception. One might even say that Merleau-Ponty has established a body discourse of the mind, while Karl Popper has established a mind discourse of the body. Both nevertheless maintain an external world view. Maurice Merleau-Ponty's work does not directly show the influence of the natural sciences on the paradigmatic construction of body images, but he did view the inner world as a make-believe phenomena. Also, both he and Karl Popper definitely underlined that the unity of the sensorium from their predecessors is a myth. Their line of thinking has resulted in a highly ambiguous relationship between the individual body and the external world. In the work of Maurice Merleau-Ponty, this ambiguity is the result of a view of science as subjectively interdependent. But at least he recognizes this subject to be rather active. "It is I who give direction, significance, and future to my life, but that does not mean that these are concepts. They spring from my present and past, and in particularly from my mode of present and past coexistence. Ex nihilo does not exist." In Karl Popper's work, this ambiguity is the result of a view of science as objectively interdependent, mainly through his concept of objective epistemology as a measurement of scientific theory and his method of falsification. It would be a mistake to say that this ambiguity did not exist in those times when the inner life of individual was still an apparent part of scientific theory. For if we view the work of Willem von Humboldt, we find an equal ambiguous interdependency. Subjective activity in thought produces an object, for no idea may be considered a mere receptive contemplation of an already present object. The activity of the senses must be combined with the intimate operation of the intellect, and from this association the idea is liberated. Such an interdependency has a completely different character once it is acknowledged to be mediated through the idea of a priori actor. For instance, von Humboldt points out that the relationship between sound of a word and the intellectual concept of a word is mediated through such an a priori actor who ensures the arousal of its meaning. Rather, the phonetic will be guided towards a phony and rhythm by the intimate string of the soul preparatory to the existence of language. Karl Popper believed that such a soul consisted of an imprinted expectations, pre-scientific logic, or dogmatic knowledge, and that individuals learn to falsify their inborn notions through trial and error. If there is something like an individual body, in Karl Popper's theory, it is passive and can only be steered to action by dogma or refutation of dogma. Popper never even contemplated that such an idea of preconditioning could lead to a form of fascism, the fascism of which he ironically accused Marx. If learning would really follow the expectations Popper considered, individuals are likely to lose their entire range of individual body experiences by what is or is not ordained and condoned in society. Such learning leads to strange conclusions about the social aspects of life. One example of this can be found in Popper's own autobiography, The Unended Quest, in which he writes about the refutation of Marxism. As the story goes, during one of the peaceful Marxist demonstrations for better labor conditions in Vienna, police shot on the unarmed and peaceful demonstrators and killed a person. Popper, as a participant of the demonstration, concluded from this event that Marxism was wrong, because it had resulted in death. He had refuted Marxism, but ironically never questioned the action of the police shooting into a peaceful crowd. Another example shows an even more of a strange refutation in society when Popper writes that the participation of Jews in the Austrian Democratic Party led to the downfall of this political party. Would the Jews not have participated, the party might have continued to exist, and the Jews might not have been deported, as democracy would have been saved. Such change of thought delivers a highly disputable concept of refutation, of course. It implies that democracy is served by being obedient to its undemocratic principles. Yet it takes individuals to be persistent in their own, albeit inborn or not, physical experience to falsify the errors in society. Not by giving up their individuality or refuting the individuality of others, but by allowing different possibilities to exist simultaneously and not exclusively. Instead of realizing how violent and unjust the Vienna police acted, or how dangerous collective anti-Semitic beliefs are, Popper thus shields authority through a scientific method. To give one other example, homosexuality would never have been accepted following Popper's ways. Examples like these beg the question how much of the concepts concerning both the external worldview and the ambiguity of the body allow for social-political justification of passivity and obedience. For instance, Merleau-Ponty's concept of ambiguity arose from man's subjective place within society, and in this respect he criticizes Sartre, but Karl Popper's concept of ambiguity arose from a fear of the consequences of being disobedient, a fear eventually leading to subjectification. I would not immediately want to imply that Merleau-Ponty's concept of ambiguity is comparable to Popper's fear, but it might be a good idea to keep in mind that with the disappearance of the inner life, a regulated religious principle also disappeared, namely that of a God-given framework. The framework itself has returned in a rather excessive form, to give a contemporary example from Charles Taylor. The very way we walk, move, gesture, speak is shaped from the earliest moments by our awareness that we appear before others, that we stand in public space, and that this space is potentially one of respect or contempt, pride or shame. Our style of movement expresses how we see ourselves as enjoying respect or lacking it, as commanding it or failing to do so. Indeed, God no longer watches us, but public space replaced him. My own true critique on the external worldview has little to do with its external character, and more with its shift in moralism, in which the social-cultural external world is supposed to be individually internalized in such a way that its morals can no longer be questioned. Whether this occurs through social sciences or through natural sciences matters very little. In Popper's case, this loss of framework drove towards uncritically accepting the authority of another framework. The fear of such loss is continuously provoked in the legacy of modern philosophy, in an almost repent and redeem yourself way, warning individuals, as Taylor is doing, not to have a framework is to fall into a life which is spiritually senseless. The quest is thus always the quest for the sense. So clean has the break with induction and the unity of the sensorium been that, compared to the theory of language which von Humboldt and others maintained in the beginning of the 18th century, language is now a fully external conditioner,
of the individual body, surpassing even Sapir's balanced view of language. Sense and framework have become mutually exchangeable, and this semantic shift in meaning does not seem to surprise anyone. The existence of language itself has become a parameter of social relations. For instance, according to Charles Taylor again, "There is no way we could be inducted into personhood except by being initiated into a language." And nowadays it seems a crime to believe anything else unless one is a believer. Again, "Not only the philosophico-scientific tradition, but also the powerful, more than aspiration to freedom and individuality, have conspired to produce an identity which seems a negation of this." It seems that we individuals are either framed or being framed into a framework. Individual body experience, however, very much like origins, cannot be known. In this sense, the private perception, even with all the modernistic connotations attached to it, might coincide in the phenomena that is nowadays labeled as postmodernism. What has happened to the individual body experience within scientific juggling at least seems to befall the same faith as postmodernism, or, as Steven Tyler says, "No one knows the beginnings of postmodernism, and appropriately so, since it denies the idea of noble origin. Some declare that it is already dead anyway, consumed perhaps by its own autopoetic dissemination or forfeit to its own deconstruction, and even though it is difficult to understand how the uncreated might be said to die, such is the desire for the new that one supposes it is capable of that too." The individual body experience as a mere matter of existence too has been death even before it could flourish. Where it rose in the history of social science, it has had only brief moments of communication to be incorporated into genre immediately before it even developed. I do not believe it is exceptional that something like postmodernism only nowadays has reached a form of relative recollection, since it seems to have been there, always. As a matter of pure speculation, it could be that the loss of the unity of the sensorium, a unity in which the boundaries of frameworks could be crossed continuously through the inner life of individual bodies, has nowadays gained its external component through postmodernism. If so, postmodernism is a necessity in fighting the historical phobia of the accumulation of models, frameworks, and their reproduction. This phobia at least seemed to dominate the opponents of postmodernism, and it is linked to a history of controlling the human body in getting rid of its passionate wildness. It colors an atmosphere in which the concept of civil society and its supposed morality is becoming in fact more important than the concept of democracy. Partly this is induced by the amount of total wars which have been fought in this century, but more ironically, it is the fear for loss of identity, partly because there is a long-standing prejudice that individual identity would collapse into pathological crisis when the boundaries of frameworks expand, or worse, cease to exist. The irony is that, according to this framed notion of identity, one would overcome his or her individual perception in order to be a self. This framework of individuality does not allow for a great many choices. In the work of Karl Popper, this framework is constructed of biological disposition vis-à-vis an interaction with a man, mostly masculine-made external world of concepts and products, which we call World 3. The rest of the body consists of what we share with animals, and this rest seemingly has no representational system, and therefore Popper considers it trivial. As much postmodernism denies the idea of noble origin, the origins of Popper theory are disposed of as dogmas. He replaces them by other origins, while simultaneously pretending to abandon the quest for origin altogether through adopting a functionalistic approach towards human development. I maintain that abandoning the idea of the unity of the sensorium in Popper's work conceptualizes the individual body as rather a questionable, ambiguous creature, which befalls the faith of the survival of the fittest. Through the principle of refutation in Popper's case, language becomes an external authority which shapes individuals into society, rather than a capacity of human beings to shape society. We can only guess the result of such an external view, and then wonder why von Humboldt wrote in the early 19th century. While languages are unambiguous sense of the word creations of nations, they still remain personal and independent creations of individuals. Recalling Popper's views concerning the participation of Jews in the Austrian political parties, and the fact that Popper believed this to be leading to suicide, one must conclude that speaking one's own language thus becomes a hazardous enterprise.